Today on Inside Utah Politics, tensions run high between the Utah legislature and Salt Lake City. How the chair of the council hopes to chart a future for both to work together. Plus, could public land help solve the housing crisis? A Utah housing expert weighs in on the plans for the federal government that they have in mind for the state. And Republicans strike out in Wisconsin. How voters there reacted to the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrts.
Well, thanks for joining us. I am Lindsay Ehrts. Let's go inside Utah politics. We begin our program with the continued fallout of a legislative session that saw state lawmakers at odds with Utah's capital city. Lawmakers received some criticism for bumping the city out of the driver's seat on issues like transportation projects. The two worked together on a lot of major projects, but over the last year, efforts to draw professional sports teams to the city have been front and center. At this week's city council work session, frustrations with the state plans for the Salt Palace seem to boil over.
It feels like Salt Lake City yet again is pitching in more. Our residents are pitching in more for the benefit. And apparently, the legislature did a study that the Salt Palace brings billions of dollars of tax revenue to our state and is a major tourist attraction. But yet, they're not willing to put any state money into it. Into that commitment.
Well, to dig into the city's issues, I'm joined today by Chris Wharton. He's the chair of the Salt Lake City Council. Chris, welcome to Inside Utah Politics.
Thanks.
We saw you in that video there. You were just sitting idly by, kind of looking at Alejandro Puy there as he was making his comments. Do you share those frustrations with the state kind of coming in and telling the city what to do?
Yeah, I think anytime that there is a message that the city should do something differently or do it better, from the state, that's difficult because we feel like we are in the best position to represent our residents and our local concerns. So yeah, it can be frustrating.
Yeah, so the issue you guys were talking about there was over the plans to help fix up the Salt Palace and the Convention Center. As the downtown revitalization comes online, we've got plans to redo the Delta Center. And then just this past session, we passed what is called SB 26. It is a bill that essentially creates the funding structure for how we pay for the Salt Palace renovations. So just walk me through what that will do and what residents should know from this bill.
Sure. Well, so last year, the legislation set forth how to do a participation agreement between the city and the team owners. So that kind of laid out the framework of what we were going to do. This new tool that was created by SB 26 is the funding mechanism to make that plan go into effect.
Okay, so it creates what's known as a public infrastructure district. That is a fancy word for let's collect the sales taxes, the increment in the sales taxes to help put back into the project. That is a very high level and probably oversimplified version of how the PID works.
That's
but here,
about
we,
it.
But here we are. So, I mean, what do you say to residents who are saying, okay, we gave a sales tax increase late last year to help fund the Delta Center renovations. And now we are, freezing these taxes to take the increment of them that could otherwise go to other areas. We're putting it back into downtown revitalization. Some are taking the position this is all to help a developer build a sports stadium and redo it. How do you see it?
I think I understand why residents would see it that way because it is very complicated. But the $900 million that we were talking about last year that would go towards the team owners for their renovation, that hasn't changed. We're talking about additional revenue above and beyond the $900 million that is going to go towards publicly owned parts of the district. So,
but that revenue might otherwise go to other city needs.
Yes.
Right. So that's where the disconnect may be.
Yes. Yeah. And that's certainly a basis for frustration as well. But I do think that the fact that so much of this is going to go into publicly owned infrastructure that is going to support not just the entertainment district, but support downtown as a whole is a really important thing for residents to understand. And then that we all are looking at other ways to continue to enhance other areas of downtown as well.
So when you say it's going to go into public infrastructure, give me an example of what that would look like.
So it could go to the convention center. It could go to a Bravenel Hall. It could go towards spaces that connect these areas downtown. That's what we're looking at mostly.
So it can go to a Bravenel Hall. I thought it could just go to the convention center.
It can go to any publicly owned part of the district.
Okay.
So I think that the plan is for the county will ultimately determine where the money goes, but under the funding mechanism, this could be used for Abravanel Hall as well.
Okay, that's good to know, because there's a lot of maintenance that needs to be done on Abravanel Hall, right?
Yes.
Are there any updates? I know that's a county-owned property, and you are obviously with the city, but any updates on what that could look like?
Not anything that I can't really give any specifics, only that they're looking at the issues that have already been identified, mostly on the back end of the building, HVAC, things like that, accessibility, and then just general upgrades to the facility.
Yeah, because the Salt Palace and Umoca are connected on a heating and cooling system, I understand, right?
Yes, yeah. That's correct. And so anything that we can use to try to improve connectivity or create a connection through that point is going to require a lot of work to be done to Abravanel Hall.
So what are we doing to the convention center?
I think what we're trying to do is just expand it, but expand it in more of a modern way. Like when you look at our convention center as compared to other cities, the footprint of our convention center is quite large, but we don't necessarily have more space. It's too spread out. So one of the things that my understanding is that the county is looking at is how to add more convention space while reducing the size of the actual footprint.
Okay, so maybe we go up as opposed
to... Or down.
Or down. Okay, all right, interesting. So back to those frustrations that the city seems to share over the state coming in and kind of dictating the processes here. This is another one of those examples where we need the funding tool to help pay for the renovations of the Salt Palace. And part of that requires a public hearing on this, you know, infrastructure district, as it's called. There was some concern this week that residents coming to voice their frustrations didn't matter. I think Victoria Petro called it a glorified therapy session, right? Because their opinions wouldn't change anything the council does. What do you say to voters who feel that way?
That we totally hear and understand those frustrations. But I really hope voters hear that they should not be deterred from coming and commenting just because on this relatively narrow issue of the PID, we're really only making sure that they meet all of the legal qualifications. And once they do, then that we must approve it. That doesn't mean, though, that the comments that we're hearing from the public on this hearing or any other hearing related to the district aren't going to help us continue to inform the decisions that are going to be made over the months and the years as we develop this area of the downtown.
Let's switch topics now. The city also approved ranked choice voting as its method for the November municipal elections. These would be city mayors. Are there council members up for election?
I sure are.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to use ranked choice voting. Talk to me about why the city thinks that's the best idea.
Yeah, so ranked choice voting gives voters more say and more options. Instead of just picking one candidate or the other, they can voice their opinions on multiple candidates. It saves taxpayer money by eliminating the need to have a primary. And also, at least in theory, it requires the candidates to be more civil towards each other because you never know who, you might be someone's number one choice, but you don't know who their two and three choices are. So you want to focus more on a positive message rather than trying to slam your opponents or discredit them because they may be someone second or third.
And you guys have done this before.
Yes.
This is not uncommon for the city, but I guess what do we like about this process as opposed to what do we not like?
The only drawback is that there is some voter education that comes with it, but that really is it. Everything else has been a positive. It saves taxpayer money because it's we can skip the primary. I believe as a candidate who has stood for election in a ranked choice format that it has helped keep things more civil and more amicable between the candidates. And I think that it also does give residents more of a choice to weigh each one of the candidates and determine which order they think is best. So it does give more say and more input from the voters.
Okay, so voters need to know that come November, rank your choices.
That's right, absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Okay, one last topic before we wrap up here. Salt Lake City has been at odds with the state over the Pride flag, and we just saw a bill banning it in schools and government properties. That would include the city county building, which often flies the pride flag. Right now, you're flying the transgender day of visibility flag. Mm-hmm. I know you're an openly gay member of the council. Does the city have any plans to kind of buck that state law, push back on it in any way?
I think we're looking at all of the options available to us. The city is going to continue to be a safe and welcoming place for everybody, and we're going to find a way to carry that message into this coming Pride Month. But yeah, as you said, the Pride flag is outside City Hall right now, waving proudly, and we're going to find a way to continue to carry that message forward.
What are your options? Is it a lawsuit? Is it something else?
Well, I think in addition to looking at legal options, we're looking at, since it only bans flags, are there other ways that we can show pride? Are there other visual ways that we can share the message that this is a welcoming and inclusive place for everyone, even if it's not with the flag, which is the way we traditionally do it?
Chris Wharton is the chair of the Salt Lake City Council. Chris, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks.
Well, still ahead on Inside Utah Politics, building housing on public land. A senior advisor to the governor explores what new federal policy could mean for Utah. Stay with us.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ahrens.
Well, welcome back. New leadership in Washington is hoping federal land may help solve housing problems in states like Utah. The Department of the Interior and Housing and Urban Development has signed an agreement to explore opening up some public land to housing development. Now, the Interior Secretary considers federal land a key asset in addressing the cost of living crisis across the country, dropping Utah by name in his pitch for the policy.
In these public land states in the West, places like Nevada, over 80% of the land in Nevada is owned by the federal government. Utah, it's over 60%. These are fast-growing urban areas, and we might have Bureau of Land Management land that abuts right up against communities.
Now, Governor Spencer Cox recently expressing his support for the idea, emphasizing his belief that we can build more housing while still protecting our state's natural beauty.
And we're not talking about building houses under delicate arch. We're talking about, this is land within the boundaries of existing cities and towns throughout the country.
Well, to explore how these plans could impact Utah, I'm joined today by Steve Waldrop. He's the governor's senior advisor for housing strategy. Steve, welcome to Inside Utah Politics.
Thank you, Lindsay. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining me. Okay, so you heard the governor there, obviously, your chief there, say that we're not going to build on delicate arch. So where is this land? Like, where does it exist most in Utah?
Yeah, no, he's exactly right. And obviously, that was an extreme example. But according to one survey, we have over 100,000 acres of federally owned land within the boundaries of existing cities.
So is this Salt Lake? Is this Utah County? Is this Tooele County? Like, where is this?
Primarily southern Utah.
Okay.
That's the biggest area where you have BLM land that, you know, cities have grown.
Okay.
Look at St. George over the last 20 years. We've grown massively. And so now you have pockets of federal land that are sitting within these city boundaries, that are sitting in urbanized areas, and they're not productive pieces of land. They're not being used as parks. They're not being used as playgrounds. They're simply pieces of dirt that are just owned by the federal government and haven't been available for productive use.
So what does this look like realistically in terms of timeline? Like, how fast does this come online? How quickly do we develop this land? What have the conversations been like?
Well, we're waiting, obviously, on Washington to give us their idea of how they're going to do this and how they're going to roll it out. We're hopeful that that's soon. We're hopeful that we can identify with them the policy, but also the areas where this can happen in a most productive way. And we want to involve the locals. We'll have the cities involved. We'll have the counties involved. We need to talk about infrastructure. We need to talk about water. We need to talk about traffic and other things. It's not just that we can just create something in the middle of nothing. We have to bring resources to the table on this.
Well, and that's part of the conversation I wanted to have here today. If you're using some of this land in southern Utah, they're in severe drought right now. How are they going to get water to these areas that you develop? Presumably these are, you know, within city boundaries, but still out there a ways, right? Rural a little bit. So what is the plan there for the basic infrastructure, water, sewer, all that stuff that needs to get to this development?
We have really good partners down in southern Utah. They've done a great job of, and I think it's been reported on, the use, the per capita use of water in southern Utah has dropped dramatically. We anticipate that to stay and continue. We've gotten really good at building water-wise developments. If you go down and drive around now, there's not lush green gardens in front of people's homes in southern Utah now. You'll see more native landscaping, you'll see rockscape, you'll see native plants. That's the kind of development that needs to happen, and that's what can happen with the right pieces of property and the right management.
You heard Governor Cox mention it there, kind of this tension between developing public land and the environment, too. That's one of the big reasons we have some federally protected land, right, is because they're pristine, they're beautiful, we need to protect them, but also the public use of them, too, is a balance, too. What's the administration's view just on how we balance those two things?
Well, I think anybody would say that the public access to recreational lands is part of what makes Utah special, part of why people want to come here. Part of our challenge is because we are doing really well. Our economy is great. Our people are great. We have a great place to live. We're very attractive. We didn't used to be so attractive. Now we are. Everybody wants to come and share what we have. And part of that magic is the access to public lands and the fact that you can live here in Salt Lake and you can be skiing in a half hour. And you can live in southern Utah and you can be on a bike trail in 10 minutes. So we need to preserve that. And again, so what we're talking about are infill pieces and pieces that are adjacent to existing infrastructure and existing cities that would ordinarily have already been developed. They would have already been in the path of progress. And we're not looking at creating controversial areas of development with this program.
So some of those pieces may be used, though, for recreation right now. How can you assure people that the lands that they love to ride their ATVs on or anything else won't just be developed, right, to make developers money, presumably?
Yeah, and that's where the coordination and cooperation of the local communities is critical. I don't think that there's any intent to do this outside of the coordination. I think we've seen, if you look at the Grand Staircase issue and Bears Ears, it's been a ping pong match. Different administrations, different results. And in all of that, what was really lacking was the engagement with the local communities, really sitting down and doing the hard work of finding a compromise. And so that's what we intend to do, is create that atmosphere of cooperation. Let's talk with people about what the highest and best use of these properties are. Is it for recreation? Is it for housing? Is it part of both? Can we integrate trails? I mean, there's a number of ways to do this right.
You heard the Secretary of the Interior there mention how critical using these lands are to solving the housing crisis. What's your take on that? I mean, is this piece just like, this is it, this is how we're going to fix it? Or obviously, there's probably more of a comprehensive approach you all have to take.
Yeah, if there was a magic silver bullet for housing, we would have pulled the trigger, and this conversation is happening all across the country right now. It is interesting to note, I think 90% of Utah's population lives on 1% of its land. So we already have high concentrations of population on very limited amounts of land, and land is our biggest constraint. Particularly when you look at southern Utah, you bump up against federal lands. On the Wasatch Front, you have a mountain range and you've got a lake, and you can't build on either of those. Mm-hmm. So land is really becoming the driving factor in our growth. If you look at growth patterns through Utah County, we're now pushing south in Utah County, we're pushing over the lake in Utah County, and that's because that is where the land is. So land really is driving what's happening in our state right now.
Well, you mentioned southern Utah as some of where this land is, but to your point, 90% of our population lives in the Salt Lake Valley and along the Wasatch Front, right? So is there land up north that butts up against city perimeters or within city limits that the federal government may want to use?
There is, and that's typically going to be Forest Service land in northern Utah and along the Wasatch Front. BLM typically does the south, Forest Service does the north. Those are all things that we'll look at as we get clarity from the administration as to what they're willing to let us look at. Obviously, we don't drive this boat. We're passengers, but hopefully we can have some influence in the direction and create really good results for the people of Utah. And I think one of the other critical things to remember is that Southern Nevada has a really, really developed program for utilizing BLM lands. They've done it for a number of years. They auction off BLM land for, I think it's $100 an acre, and they use it for low-income housing and kind of public benefit housing. So there's models out there that we can follow so it's not viewed and doesn't become a giveaway to developers, doesn't become a giveaway in spite of the public interest. It becomes for the public interest. We want to make sure that water gets all the way to the end of the row.
Governor Cox has 35,000 starter homes in 5 years. How many have we built thus far?
Just under 5,000.
Okay.
In the first year, which is good.
Okay.
It's a great start. We need to do better. We need 7,500 a year. So the challenge with housing, we're very used to adding water and things magically appear. Housing is not that way. Housing, the things we do this year, we're going to be 9, 12, 18 months before we start to see the impact of those. Some of the things we did 3 years ago are now just coming to fruition. So we're anxious and confident that we've been taking the right steps, but it takes time.
Clock's ticking. We got 4 years left, 3 years right. on the administration.
That's right.
Steve Waldrop, senior advisor to Governor Cox on housing. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Well, coming up, liberals will maintain their 4-3 hold on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Why that result could have a national impact. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ayres.
The race for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court seems to have gone against the president and Elon Musk's wishes. Liberal-backed Susan Crawford won the seat handily over conservative Brad Schimmel. It was the most expensive state judicial race in the nation's history, with over 100,000 donors from all 50 states contributing to both campaigns. Now, groups linked to Musk alone spent more than $17 million to support Schimmel. Many saw the race as a temperature check for how voters feel about Trump's first few months in office. But Musk set the stakes higher, saying control of the House was at stake.
Normally, an election for a judge would not be that big of a deal. It just so happens that in this case, it could decide the control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Which is, a huge deal.
Well, both campaigns criticized one another for taking large amounts of out-of-state donations, and that seemed to be on voters' minds heading into the polls as well.
It just bugs me to think that somebody, who has inherited a bunch of money and has a business that is supported by taxpayer dollars, government grants, and that's not enough for you?
Well, I definitely went Crawford. I don't like the extreme views on the other side, and I don't like the money behind the other side.
Well, with Crawford's projected win, the court's liberals will maintain their 4-3 majority as the court weighs issues like abortion, voting rules, redistricting congressional maps, and union rights. Now to Florida, where Republicans saw far better results. They won two special elections to fill seats vacated by appointments to the Trump administration. Republicans Jimmy Patronis and Randy Fine will bolster the GOP majority in the House to 220 seats. Patronis will be replacing Matt Gaetz, who resigned the seat when the president tapped him to be attorney general. Gaetz, of course, withdrew from consideration over allegations of sexual misconduct. Now, Fine is replacing Mike Waltz, Trump's national security advisor, at the center of the Signalgate controversy. Well, that does it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure to reach out. You can always email InsideUtahPolitics@abc4.com. Also, you can follow along on social media. I am on X, Blue Sky, Threads, and Instagram, Lindsay On Air, and Lindsay spelled with an A. You can also find our show online in podcast form. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ayres wherever you get your podcasts. Well, that's all for us today on Inside Utah Politics. We will see you next week.